Hello, everyone. Welcome to the TeamCast. I am Dr. Preston Klein, Director of Research and Education at the Mission Critical Team Institute. The TeamCast is a show where my colleagues, Goldman Ruiz, Claire Murphy, Harry Moffitt, and myself, along with our guests, discuss all things Mission Critical Teams. Mission Critical Teams are teams of 4 to 12 people who are indigenously trained and educated and who solve rapidly emerging complex adaptive problem sets. MCTs work in immersive environments of 300 seconds or less where the consequence of failure is death or catastrophic loss. Regardless of whether you are a Mission Critical Team or not, we aim to bring you the broadest range of topics and guests as possible. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you enjoy the TeamCast. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the TeamCast. My name is Dr. Preston Klein. I'm today joined by Dr. David Gens, professor of surgery at University of Maryland Shock Trauma. We've known each other for a few years now, and he has finally agreed to come on and spend a little time talking about his career in medicine and specifically at Shock Trauma, but prior to that. So first, I just want to welcome you. Thank you very much for coming.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we're going to go back in time a little bit. You went to med school in Brussels.
Correct.
Yeah. And you graduated med school in 1976.
Correct.
What led you at that time to go abroad to medical school?
Well, that's relatively complicated. It was difficult to get into medical school back then, which would have been in the 60s.
Yeah.
Primarily because a lot of young men were deferring themselves from going into the military because of Vietnam. And therefore, there were a lot of places taken up for people who didn't really weren't that enthusiastic, but were more enthusiastic about not getting drafted.
Yeah.
You were deferred from medical school, to the point at which I remember distinctly in 68, leaning over to my lab partner in it was chemistry, I think, biochemistry, leaning over to him and say, "Hey," I don't remember his name, like, "Hey, Joe, what are you doing next year?" And he said, "Well, I got into Harvard Law and I got into Yale Medical School." I said, "Well, what are you going to do?" He said, "Well, I don't want to go to Vietnam, so I'll have to go to med school. Although I'd rather be a lawyer."
Wow.
So that was happening.
Good.
So we had a few places. That's one. Now, of course, I didn't have the great grades that it took at the time because I wasn't applying myself. So this is what I learned. It's time to get serious. And so I left the country. July 20th, 1969, the day we landed on the moon.
Yeah.
Missed the whole thing. I was in the air. And that's where it all started. So that was my trip to, for 7 years, I stayed in Belgium. And I'm really thankful to them for allowing me to do that at no cost. They did not charge anything. Your education in Belgium guaranteed. It was from birth, cradle, to death, your education is guaranteed. So there are a lot of, there were students from US, Norway, and Israel. I had a lot of Israeli and Norwegian friends because we all had the same situation, not enough places. And then the Belgians, they offered that to anyone who wanted to come and get educated. So that's not why I went. I went because I wanted to go to medical school. So that's what they offered me. So that's why I landed there, and I'm glad I did. It was great.
Nice. Now, well, if we fast forward 5 years later, you found yourself now at George Washington University. You've moved up the residency. You're now chief resident.
Yeah.
And along comes March 30th, 1981. So what are you doing at that moment, March 30th, 1981?
I am chief resident at GW University Hospital, George Washington University Hospital. And I was chief resident with another chief, Paul Colombani. We eventually went into pediatric surgery, became chief of pediatric surgery at Hopkins. Anyhow, I remember the day itself.
Yeah.
I believe it was a Monday. We were sitting in a room where we were able to sit for residents, and we were going over journal club for that evening, where you go over articles, you discuss them. And there was a third person, Brad Bennett, in the room. And our papers went off. We meet and come down to the ER. Paul and I said, "Brad, you go. You know, you're the younger. You're not the chief yet. So you go. You call us if you need us." So he went down first, but then our beepers kept going off incessantly. So Paul and I said, "Well, I guess there's really something." So we went down to our ER at GW, And Monday is when we switched services. That week before, I was on the general surgery service, not the trauma service. Monday of that day, Paul and I switched. And I was chief of trauma, and he wasn't. So I get my pick. I just said, I'll go to that bay there, which happened to be Reagan.
President Ronald Reagan.
And he went to the left. That was the policeman named Tim McCarthy, who'd been shot in the abdomen. And I went to Reagan, who was shot in the chest. So what was odd was when I arrived, the personnel, I've forgotten who it was, said to me, the president's been shot. And you know that nanosecond where you really think, you don't figure things out.
Right.
But that nanosecond, I thought it was the president of the university, O'Leary, I think was his name. And then it dawned on me, they're talking about the president of the United States. And we took care of everything. I don't know if you want me to go into that.
Well, I guess what I would be curious, I think our listeners would be curious, is you're chief resident, which means that you have bosses, and they must have shown up at some point.
Yeah, they probably had, like, without having to talk to them about exactly before.
Yeah.
I never asked them, what kind of patients did you get?
Yeah.
And I'm sure they did the same thing we did, but a little more delayed. I'll let the residents.
Yeah.
Good. They probably didn't know it was present. I'm sure they didn't know because we weren't told that.
Yeah.
Until we got there. It's interesting you say that because the resident, Wesley Price, had arrived before me and he realized the president had a gunshot wound to the chest and had bled a lot into the chest and was having trouble breathing. So I said, Wesley, what do you got? He said, the president's got a gunshot wound to the left chest. And we'll need to put a chest tube in. And so I'm ready with Wesley to do the chest tube, which you have to make an incision, numb the skin up as much as you can, and then make an incision with a scalpel about an inch and a half to 2 inches, and get a clamp and poke into the chest and slide a tube in. Just then, talking about chiefs,
yeah,
my chief of trauma surgery, the attending,
yeah,
Joe Giordano showed up, tapped me on the shoulder. I'm holding the chest. Yeah. Said, what you got, Dave? I said, the president's shot, left chest, having trouble breathing. It was low blood pressure.
Yeah.
In the 80s, just to let anyone know who understands that. Number 120s, your kind of normal pressure. His normal probably should have been 130, 140. So we're talking about significant blood loss.
Yeah.
And so Joe's tapped me, said, hey, what do you got? I told him, said, you know, for this one, and I know what he said. I know what he meant.
Yeah.
For this one, I really should do it.
Yeah.
It really was not that he thought he had to get the award.
Sure.
But he did it thinking, if I did anything wrong, the whole world would know.
That's right.
So he was really protecting me as much as anything else. And I know, because I know the way he said that. I should do this one just because.
Yeah.
So handed the tube to him. Joe Giordano put the chest to bed. Okay. Now, I've been places where people introduce me as Dr. Gens here, save the president by putting the chest tube in. And I have to I correct everyone. I did not. I tell you a funny story.
Yeah.
10 years later. Maybe 15 years later, I get invited by GW, Department of Surgery, to give a grand rounds where you speak in front of the whole Department of Surgery. And I happen to have given that on vascular trauma. But the night before, a visiting professor always gets asked out to dinner with the resident staff and the chief of surgery. Well, Joe Giordano was now chief. So I go to this restaurant. The residents are all there sitting around the table. I introduced myself. Oh, yeah, Dr. Gens. And Joe hadn't arrived yet. So I'm just alone with them. And they said to me, oh, Dr. Gens, it's so good to meet you because you're the one who put the chest tube in the president. I said, well, wait a minute. You guys at GW, Joe Giordano is your chair of the Department of Surgery. And you think I put the tube in? This is crazy because your chair, your chief, he put the tube in. I'm surprised you don't know that. No. So I was flabbergasted that even GW people,
yeah,
surgery residents, didn't know that their chair had put the actual tube in.
Now, at the time, you're 5 years out of med school. You've been a resident. How many gunshot wounds have you seen? Like quite a few? Yeah.
GW.
Yeah.
Middle of D.C. near DuPont Circle. Plenty.
Okay.
Plenty. You've seen a lot of people die from gunshot. What did you see? A lot of people survive. Chest tubes, surgeries. Oh, yeah. So that was nothing new.
Okay. Now, I'm going to pause here because you and I have been having this ongoing conversation because, as the listeners know, that I've written a part on paper on residue. We talk a lot about acute stress and long-term stress. And I often will ask you, I would say, how do you deal with the stress? And I just would like you to share your answer to with the audience because I would find it fascinating.
Well, you'd think, you know, when you talk about there's the highest person in the United States of being known and in the position of everything, you'd think everyone would be stressed. No, that's very odd. I mean, I look back on it and say, I wasn't stressed at all, nor was anyone else. I wasn't stressed. Joe wasn't stressed. The thoracic surgeon, Ben Aaron, of all of this, I would say, of all these people, he's the hero because he had to make the decision to do a chest surgery. But going back to stress, no, it's odd, but it's your job. You're doing your job and you don't think of it that way. You don't say, I better do my job and not have stress. You just do it. It's almost routine.
Yeah.
I have to say, even the president, it becomes routine. Even the president.
What about the day after or the week after?
Well, I remember that night when I stayed that night in the hospital, I slept in the dialysis unit. And I remember thinking, it finally dawned on me. You know, dawned on me, this is this is an international event that everyone's going to be looking at. It was nighttime, about 9 or 10 o'clock. So this is 8-10 hours later that it sort of dawned on me, oh, yeah, this is a big deal. And I still wasn't nervous or anything, but that's when I realized it. Wow, this is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, but it was more of intellectual rather than sort of, you know, that you had the shakes or anything else. It was
wow, this is really big.
Yeah.
And still didn't affect us. Interesting, this next day, we were all asked to go to the president of the university's office. I think it was Dennis O'Leary. I think that's the same. To let us know that we were taking care of the president, that we are not to talk to the press, not to do anything. We will be hounded by them. But interestingly enough, that wasn't the case. No one ever approached me. And they could have easily come in and out of the hospital. Who's the chief for us? Because I was assigned, well, I'll tell you, the first day, rounds. So you make rounds, which means a team goes sees each patient. So to make rounds on the president of the United States, because his press secretary, James Brady, had been shot in the head. So the neurosurgery people said, well, we better make rounds with you to see the president. And then all the general surgery people, and there was about 20 people in the room. And Nancy was there. We left. So the chief of thoracic surgery, who did the surgery, myself, Paul Colombani, the other chief resident, who had taken care of McCarthy, myself, then the chief of general surgery, the chief of this, chief of that, all these people. So we left the room, and about 10 minutes later, Giordano got a call. It was the person speaking for Nancy. Nancy does not want that entourage size. Pare it down to 3. So since I was the trauma chief resident for that week or two, I was appointed to be the president's resident, to see him every day, change his dressings, do all the stuff he's supposed to do, draw the blood work, all that stuff. And Ben Aaron, of course, still was the thoracic surgeon, and Paul was there to fill in for me if I weren't there. So 3 of us made rounds every day.
So here's my question. So I imagine the whole world's looking at this hospital. The president's involved. All of your bosses are involved. Why didn't they take over? Why didn't the bosses come in and be like, okay, you're residents. We're actually the attendings. We're actually going to do the rounds.
I'd be honest with you. The people at GW that I was with, my co-chief, Dr. Ben Aaron, chief of thoracic surgery, Joe Giordano, chief of trauma surgery. We were all normal people, and you weren't there to take over us, to get glory. No one was there for anything glory. And Joe, as I said, when he said, I'll put the tube in, he did it to make sure if anything happened wrong or criticism, I wouldn't get criticized. That's why he did it.
Okay.
So those are the people who were there.
Was there ever a time during those following days where you got concerned about whether the president would survive, or was it mostly there was the prognosis pretty good from the beginning?
Well, in the ER, a trauma patient with a blood pressure of 80, I think at one time it was less, 80 is very low. You're on your way to arresting. He didn't arrest, but that's extremely low. So that's the only time he could have easily died. I tell you something, when he was shot, he was shoved into the limousine by Jerry Parr, Secret Service guy. Jerry Parr pushed him in the back, the floor of the back, landed on him. And luckily, President Reagan coughed up a little blood, which is unusual for gunshot wounds to the chest. Unusual. When you see blood from a gunshot wound to the chest, from the lung, if at all they have any blood coughed up, it's 2 or 3 days later.
Okay.
And it's a small amount. But right then and there, Jerry saw blood on his lips. They were headed to the White House. And Jerry Parr said, no, go to the nearest trauma center, which is GW.
Good.
Had they gone, anyone who knows this, had they gone to the White House, which is basically an infirmary, and they had just saline solutions, which are salt solutions, not blood, he would have died. Absolutely. Ask Joe, ask myself, ask Ben Aaron, anyone who was there and knows, and anyone who knows trauma.
Yeah.
Forgot how old he was. He was 70-something, blood pressure of 80, gunshot wound, bleeding a lot, and goes to an infirmary, he would have died.
Okay.
I'm confident of that. So Jerry Parr made the first crucial decision, going around DuPont Circle and going to the GW, not to the White House, which is blocks of, you know, GW is two blocks or three blocks down the road in Pennsylvania Avenue.
And so in the days that followed, as you're going in and out, you're dealing with Nancy, you're dealing with the President Reagan. What's that like? I mean, anytime you're dealing with family members, it's a challenge. But in this particular case, it is the family.
What was interesting is technically, the president's supposed to go to where they have a presidential suite for him, which is at the time was Walter Reed. And Walter Reed Military Hospital, he's chief of the military, said you should bring him here. But he was still in the ICU. And Nancy had to make the decision. We offered her a whole suite. We would repaint his room, which we did. It was crazy because it smelled like paint. And so we said we'd offer that. So she says, okay, fine. So we kept him. That's how we kept him.
Okay.
And then she and Mike Deaver was one of the three people who were not press secretaries, but got the confidants, the people talking to him. Deaver, Jim, I forgot his name. Meese, Deaver, and Brady. No, I can't remember. Anyhow, Deaver was in charge of those three. So Deaver and Nancy said, we want to meet every day, 2 o'clock, medical meeting with Ben Aaron and whomever, which is me, every day. The presidents all have their own physician. Dan Ruge, who is a neurosurgeon. Nancy's father knew Dan Ruge through neurosurgery. So he was picked as the president's physician, which means you're the informant between the president and Nancy to the medical world. So if there's on antibiotics or something, they would say why. So here's who was myself, Ben Aaron, Ruge from the president's staff, Nancy and Mike Deaver, four of us, or five of us. Met every day at 2 o'clock. Of that, Nancy drove the bus.
Yeah.
She absolutely drove the bus. And you couldn't get anything. I don't want to use the word get it by her, but if you said something that you were hedging on, she picked it up. For instance, he had on his chest x-ray, he had a splotch. Now, I know what that was now. That was just from the bullet going through the lung and causes a contusion, which is a bruise to the lung. But it looked like you had pneumonia. So after several days of being there, we decided you had a fever, you had the splotch, it looked worse. So meeting with Nancy. Well, what's going on? Well, Ms. Reagan, we are. There's a splotch on the chest. I said, we're going to put a man in a box. Oh, he has an infection? Well, we're not. We don't think so. We think it's a bruise or contusion. Well, which is it? Is it an infection or not? Well, we don't think so. Well, why is he on antibiotics then? We had to be very careful what we said because she was
quite smart,
clever, and smart. Yeah. And she protected him.
Nice.
Now, here's a good story. Yeah. If I'm doing this, if we're talking about this whole thing, it's a really good story. First day, Deaver, Mike Deaver, who represented the president from the White House, said, actually, the White House wants to know because the Washington Post wants to know how he's doing and could we have a picture? And we all said, no. No, he can't. He's got an oxygen cannula and plastic in his nose. He's got a chest tube in his left chest. We're not talking. Next day, I'm every 2 o'clock. I'm meeting there. Deaver, we really need a picture. And Nancy looked at me and said, can you take that ugly piece of plastic out of his nose? I said, no, that's oxygen. He needs that still. She turns to Deaver and says, no. Third day, Mike Deaver, this is 2 o'clock. Said, now, tell you what, the White House has called and said they've already written the story that he's dying and that you guys are shielding this, making it up, that he actually is dying and you're not saying anything about it. We need a picture. Nancy turns to me. Dr. Gans? I said, well, yes, we could take that oxygen cannula off for a while. Cannot take the chest tube out. It's still draining blood. So the photographer's there. I'm standing behind the photographer. And there's Reagan. Nancy's on his right side. He's on her left side. If you look closely, if you ever Google first picture in the hospital, Ronald Reagan after assassination, if you Google that, you see the picture of Nancy standing next to Ronnie. Now, look closely. He is listing when leaning to the left. That's his hurt side. And that's where the chest tube is. But you can't see the chest tube because it's cropped out. And standing 2 feet away from him is the nurse holding the container that collects all the blood. And if you look, you'll see what exactly I mean. He's leaning, he's listing.
Yeah.
And as soon as we've got the picture, put the cannula back on, put him right back to bed.
That's amazing.
It's a cool thing. So I love people doing that, looking and saying, yeah, you're right. He's leaning to the left. That's because his left chest got, has the incision.
And what was he like?
Very quiet and calm. Well, every day I sat in the room with him. I made rounds on him. That was the one to make rounds. And I wrote every note in the chart for the medical aspect of it. And he was just very nice, quiet. The opposite of Nancy in terms of, but he was just pleasant, nice, quiet. Now, I was asked, years later, when he developed Alzheimer's, did it seem like he had Alzheimer's then? My answer was, well, I'll tell you something. I'm drawing blood out of his left arm. He's got newspapers, and he's reading them as I'm taking blood out. He's got 3 newspapers he read every day. New York Times, Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times, I think what it was. 3 newspapers. He didn't have Alzheimer's then.
Yeah.
He was cool. We talked about stuff like farming. As anyone who knows me well knows, I split wood with a maul, and he liked to split wood too. And I gave him grief about he used a wood splitter.
Yeah.
And he's not using a maul. By the way, he was a very healthy 70, whatever he was. He was very healthy looking, broad shoulders, good. I mean, he was an actor after all. In Hollywood. Very nice. He was extremely nice and never pulled rank in the hospital. Never.
Yeah.
Never complained, never did any, no, nothing.
So he recovers, he leaves the hospital. What was your life like at the end of, did it change at all?
Nothing
changed?
No. We did go to the White House twice.
Yeah.
One, Ben was so good to us too. Ben was asked, we sent him on antibiotics to the White House. And so we did have to do a post-op visit. He wasn't going to come to us to the clinic.
Right.
We went there. So it was very nice. We went to the White House to visit medically. and went up to his suite upstairs on the second floor. And Ben, listened to his heart and lungs and stuff like that. Ben examined that. So that was kind of cool. But we did get invited back officially with the picture, you know, in the room where the fireplace is. I don't know what the room is called. It's called not the Lincoln Room, but some room. You see all the heads of states there, the fire's about fire. So that's, we were in that. We have a, that's the picture for the family, for everyone who comes. The picture is of Reagan, Ben Aaron, myself, and Paul Colombani, the four of us in that room. That's the famous picture for my family, at least.
That's nice.
So we went twice. And then at the 10-year anniversary, they had a quote-unquote reunion at GW, and I met them back in and talked with Nancy because, you know, we were close, personal.
Nice. That's lovely. So you end up finishing your residency,
yeah,
and now you can go work probably anywhere, right?
I suppose.
And so you chose University of Maryland Shock Trauma, which, for those that don't know, was officially created in 1960, even though the research leading up to it had been going on a while. But in the grand scheme of things, a relatively new phenomenon in the world.
Yes.
And so what drew you to go there?
Simply going into surgery. And we all have, once we decide you're going to be a surgeon, then you have what kind of surgeon. And we all have our predilections. So I like something to be answered quickly, solve it, done. That's trauma.
Yeah.
Cancer surgery, I liked as well. But it was different. It was a longer haul, so to speak. I liked quick, fast ER, gunshot wound, stab wound, whatever it was, figure it out, operate or not operate. And on top of that, part of my residency in my third year was to do 3 months of trauma surgery at the Shock Trauma Center as a resident. 1979, I believe. Yeah, 1979, 3 months at Shock Trauma. So I got the taste of a real trauma center and knew what it was. Joe Giordano had learned trauma going there to see how things ran. So, and Joe was our chief of trauma. So that was an allure as well, that Joe knew trauma and I learned from him. So where to go to do my trauma fellowship? That's once again, after residency, but before you're an attending surgeon. So I figured, where's the best place? Well, first of all, something close by. But the best place at the time, and still is, by the way, still is. I don't brag about much, but I would say, not bragging, if someone asked me, they want to do fellowship in trauma, where's the best place? I still say the place I work, because it still is the best place to work. Very busy, the busiest place in the country. But my allure to it was residency, surgery, third year residency doing trauma surgery at the Shock Trauma Center and realize I like this. I like fast paced, boom, figure it out, do it. That's me.
Yeah. So we're going to fast forward a little bit. We're not too much, but I want to give some context to the listeners. So you've been an attending surgeon at Shock Trauma for a few years now. And in the last few years, you've moved to a role that is much heralded. You now have the David R. Genn Shock Trauma Endowed Fellowship in your name that supports the development of trauma surgeons, young trauma surgeons at Shock Trauma. Is that accurate?
Pretty close.
Okay.
It's the David R. Genn's MD Endowment for Medical Students at the University of Maryland Medical School. In the memorandum of understanding, it is for students who decide they want to go into trauma surgery or emergency medicine, but not exclusively, but preferably. So we recognize a student who wants to go into surgery, maybe trauma surgery, preferably, and also an element of need too, to help them out. So Tom Scalia, who's the head of trauma, Shock Trauma, he did that for me, basically, because he recognized how much I like to educate. And part of that is the fact that it's just for students, and I educate a lot of students. My job has morphed. I was a trauma surgeon after fellowship, which was 2 years from 81 to 83. 83 July, I started at Shock Trauma as an attending. I'm still there as an attending. But around COVID, my family, children, said, you know, you really shouldn't go up to the critical care units and make rounds because a lot of those patients are COVID patients. And sort of had an understanding with Dr. Scalia that I wouldn't be taking call anymore or doing rounds anymore, which is fine, but that I would have other jobs. Now, we didn't really say what else. He knew I would be educating. So my primary job is educating, and I'm still clinically very active. And I am medical director of our outpatient facility, which is clinic, if you will.
Yeah.
So all patients who are in our trauma center are offered at least one visit back. Some have to come back many times. So that's my job now, is running the clinic. And I educate medical students in the clinic too.
Yeah. So I don't want to embarrass you, but I was just at your birthday party.
Yeah.
And so are you willing to share with listeners how old you are right now?
Sure. I'm 80 years old. Just turned 80 years old. April 23rd, William Shakespeare's birthday.
Yeah.
And Shirley Temple's birthday.
Yeah.
And my birthday.
So I just want to put out to listeners that when he says that during COVID, he decides that he just doesn't want to do as much, you're in your 70s at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's a pretty reasonable, like, you've done your time in the trenches a little bit.
Well, COVID was, let's say, I know when it started, 2019, let's say 2020. So that's 6 years ago. It's 74.
Yeah. Okay.
And I'm not stopping.
No. I can attest to that. I met you on a sailboat, so I can attest to that. I think the where I'd like to take it now is, if you go online right now, and I'm not trying to embarrass you at all, but just if you go online, David Genz is considered sort of one of the leading authorities. And if you look at who's developed the science of developing trauma surgeons in the world, you're certainly in the pantheon of people that have contributed to how we develop trauma surgeons to do that work.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start with, you know, in this show, we often talk about the tacit knowledge transfer problem. And for listeners, again, that's, you know how to ride a bike, but you don't have to explain it to someone else. You know how to swim, but you can't explain it to someone else. And whenever you're learning a new task, a skill set, a mindset, especially in a critical environment, not a routine environment, a critical. So we've got urgency, we've got criticality, we've got consequence. There's always that moment where you are a resident, so now you're at Shock Trauma, you're now an attending, and now you've got residents under you. And there's always going to be a moment where it's going to be the first time that resident actually takes the scalpel or puts in the chest tube. They've got to do it the first time at some point. And so let's pretend for a second I'm that resident, and I'm walking up next to you, you're walking up next to me, and I'm about to do the thing. What are you looking for? What are you looking for in my behavior? What are the kind of things you might say to me?
You don't look for, but you just, it's hard to explain. It's not like I'm looking at you saying, I wonder, you know, you just sort of know. I don't know. We've talked about this before.
Yeah.
You sort of know. What do you mean by that? What it is, I've come to conclude this, is something to do with how you look in terms of confidence.
Yeah.
And that comes through your face and the way you walk and the way you carry yourself, which I call comportment, your comportment, how your shoulders are set, how you're, just how you act. And I can tell this person with confidence is going to be good. I'll let them proceed. You can just, I don't know how to describe it. I remember reading Malcolm Gladwell, Blink.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And in Blink, he talks about in a blink of an eye, you have this person. And it really comes down to the face. I don't know what it is. He tries to describe it. So it's sort of the same thing. Now, in surgery, that new resident, if you're really new, walks into your OR with a mask on. So how do you tell? Because I can't see the face. I can see the eyes and the forehead, the way they walk, the way they carry the comportment, with confidence or not with confidence. That's it. Then you decide whether or not you're going to let them make the incision, whether or not you're going to let them mobilize the colon. And I'll never forget, I was a second-year resident at GW operating with the surgeon's surgeon, Dr. Vince Yervin. Everyone knew him. He was a gruff guy, tough, but the best. I remember I was his resident doing a colon operation, and I expected to hold the hooks, to retract the whole time. And I had, there were medical students, there were two medical students at the table, and I'm the resident. And he sets himself up as the primary surgeon. He says at the start, now, students, Watch as Dr. Gens makes the incision. Oh, God. It's like, oh, okay. Makes the incision. Now, watch as Dr. Gens mobilizes the, it was a right colon cancer,
yeah.
mobilizes the right colon, cutting through the white line of Tolt, which, okay. So he's really telling me what to do.
Right.
But he's letting me do it. And watch as Dr. Gens mobilizes the tumor and watch as Dr. Gens cuts the colon in and does the vesentary. Watch him do this. It was so nice of him to do that because other people he was very mean to.
Yeah.
And it was funny because sewing the colon back together after the tumor is out, I hit a vessel, which is not a good idea because that's the blood supply
yeah.
to your anastomosis.
Yeah.
So everything, watch Dr. Gens do this, watch Dr. Gens do that. And then when I hit the vessel, oh my God. we saw. And then it was, okay, watch this again as he closes the abdomen. But then I realized years and years later, even talking with you, gosh, Dr. Levine really had confidence in me to allow me to do all this stuff. You know, he's helping me through it. And he must have seen something in me that said, this kid's confident. I can let him do this. And that's what it is. I think that's probably true with a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
That how do you know? This is the Malcolm Gladwell thing. 80% of the time you're right, by the way.
Yeah.
20% of the time you're wrong. 80% of the time you're right about that person and what you think about them, that blink.
Yeah.
That 80% and 20% you're wrong. So I guess the same thing's probably true about I see this kid walk in the OR or I meet him for the first time on the floor. Can I trust them? Is he good? Does he carry himself well, confidence? And that's what we see in our fellows. Fellows have finished their surgical training. Now they're doing 2 years of trauma fellowship. Same thing. Is this kid good? Is he good? Can I trust him? Can I follow? Will he be good?
So trust is a huge thing. Do you find that comportment issue presents differently in men and women, or is it the same in that environment?
Same.
Same.
Same. It's the same thing. People. Human.
Yeah.
Human beings. And once again, I'll go back to Malcolm Gladwell. The face is a window to who you are.
Sure.
Because what do you look at first when you meet someone? You look at the face. And it's that blank subconscious that says, I think I like this guy or not. A funny story I tell. I was telling the medical students one morning. Every 2 weeks, I have a new set of medical students, six at a time. And I see every medical student in each class. I'm the only one who does. Telling these kids a story about Malcolm Gladwell, blink, how 80% of the time you're right, 20% of the time you're wrong. And then tell them a story about the new chair of the Department of Anesthesiology. This was years and years ago, Peter Rock, new chair. And I told him, you know, when I first saw this guy, I didn't say I don't like him. I knew subconsciously, I'm not going to ask him out for a drink. I'm not going to ask him over to the house to have dinner with my wife. You know, he's not my ilk,
yeah,
so to speak. I told him the story. What happened, we were all invited to a dinner of someone, a chair was retiring. So I was invited to this chair's dinner. He was invited to. So I didn't want to sit with him. I didn't know him then. And they had name tags, name places. And I was sitting next to Peter Rock, and I saw that, and I was, oh my God, this is going to be so boring. This is going to be so awful. Like, oh gosh, can I change the name? So he sits down with me. We had a great time.
Yeah.
I was so wrong. I tell the students, that was my 20%er. I love him. We turned out to be good friends. He was very helpful to me and part of my career. He was great. And so I told the students the story. There's my 20%er. Peter Rock was my 20%er. I was wrong subconsciously. So guess what? One of them goes through rotation in anesthesia for as a student. He tells Peter Rock, oh, by the way, Dr. Gens, I'm in coffee, getting coffee at we have a Starbucks in the hospital. I'm getting coffee and I get a tap on my shoulder. I turn around, it's Peter Rock.
I hear you don't like me.
Many years later.
Oh, and I told him. And he laughed. Because they told him the whole story about Malcolm Gladwell, 20%. Yeah. So, it was funny.
That's awesome. Funny. So let's say that you think I have comportment. So you have a sense of trust that I'm going to do something. I take the scalpel. And what do you do? You give me a Braveheart speech? Do you?
No.
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 What do you say?
Go go. Do it.
Do it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Do it.
Yeah.
What are you waiting for?
Yeah.
I do this all the time with the students in a clinic. You know, they're brand new. They're waiting to see a patient. They're not, they don't know what to do. I said, go get in that room. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
To the scrub nurse, Joe Schmo is going to pick up the scalpel.
Yeah.
So go. Give the scalpel to Joe Schmo. And they look at me like, okay.
Yeah.
I even did that with a student once who was going into surgery, fourth year student. He's so floored that I let him open an abdomen as a medical student. And the resident, the chief resident, said, what the hell is going on? I'm supposed to be doing that. But it was fun.
Yeah.
Anyhow, so yeah, you don't dilly-dally. You say, hand the scalpel to Joe Schmo, you're opening.
Yeah.
Or you decide you're not going to scrub immediately. You let them start, the chief resident or the fellow and the resident.
Yeah.
And you tell the chief or the fellow, hey, this kid's pretty good. Why don't you let him open? You might want to let him open. You might want to let him open, not let him open. Because allow that chief resident or that fellow to decide, do I have the confidence to let someone else do it for me? It tells me a lot about the chief resident
or
the fellow. Does he have the confidence to allow someone else to?
Yeah. Do you ever, that story you told where that doctor was like, now Dr. Gens is going to do this. Do you ever do that to other people?
No. Well, not like Vince Gervin did to me.
Yes.
It was so beautiful. I'll say something that now he'll mobilize the splenorenal ligament, and that's about it.
Okay.
If they're stuck, you know, now as I wouldn't say, hey, you bozo, what are you doing?
Sure.
I just be to the student, and by the way, now watch as he mobile. And I do that because it echoes in my mind, Vince Gervin.
Yeah.
Now he will do this, meaning that's your next step, kid.
Yeah. When I was doing my doctoral research, I spent a little bit of time with Dr. Schwab at University of Pennsylvania, trauma unit there. And what he was explaining to me, he says that part of the reason that in this conversation we're having, and when I was asking him, he said, part of the reason I can do that is because for the most part, I can fix any mistake they make within the first 24 hours, for the most part. And he says, so I have a little bit of latitude. And I wanted to just send that by you to say, do you think, does that ring true for you?
It is true. It is true.
Yeah.
But I hate the thought of having to fix. He's right. But in my mind, I don't let him get that far to make that mistake that I have to fix. But he's right. There's nothing that you'll let them do that you couldn't resolve.
Yeah.
But in my mind, I don't think I ever let them get that far to get me in a hole that I had to do that. No. But he's right.
Yeah.
You can always reverse a small error, small error. You never let them make a big error.
So let's do the reverse. So I show up, I don't have the compartment. My hands may be shaking a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No.
What do you do in that situation?
Scrub. Let's go. Let's start this case. I start the case. I mobilize the spleen. I mobilize the colon.
Okay.
If it's just, no.
And you'll walk them through it, but they won't get anywhere near the scalpel.
Not the scalpel, but the scissors to mobilize the organ. It's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough because I'll give you an example of a certain case where there are two sides to it.
Yeah.
There's a certain procedure that I did a lot of where we fixing a very large hernia of the middle of the abdomen, and we had a left and a right side to mobilize the muscles and the fascia. It's a component release. That's the name of it, component release of the abdominal fascia. Now, the two sides. And I would always do my side and say to the, it's hard to do. To the fellow or resident, here's how I do this. I cut the this fascia and let it expand, all these things. Now I have to make a decision. Do I hand the scissors over to the resident on the other side and say, here, you do it because you just saw me do it? Or do I not even say anything? I just, let's change sides. Now, there are a lot of procedures. It's funny because I teach surgery in what we used to call boot camp for students going into surgery until they do residency. Yeah. So there's a certain time that you're doing that something has a bilaterality, like a neck dissection or this component thing I told you about, where you, the attending, have to decide, do I let the kid do his side or do I say, do I just switch sides? That's where you make the decision. So you've built up confidence, how they retract, how they assist you, let's say. the kid's pretty good. He understands the steps here. He understands my next movement. Oh, that's good. I'll let him do his side.
Okay.
Or her side.
Yeah.
Or, whoa, this kid's way behind, and I don't like the way you don't say this, but yeah. Subconscious doesn't handle this, the scissors well, doesn't handle the clamps well, didn't assist well. I'm not so sure I want him to do that.
What happens if there's too many of those? What happens if day after day after day, you're like, oh, I'm not sure I want this kid touching this?
I'd be upset.
Yeah.
I'd be upset if they were in the residency program enough for you to say, oh my God, this is happening again. This kid knows nothing. I'd be very upset.
Yeah. Is there a recourse? Is there a way to change them to another profession?
No, you know what there is? What? You leave.
Oh, okay.
No, if your residency program has a lot of residents who really don't know how to operate themselves out of a paper bag,
yeah,
something's wrong with your program.
I see.
Is there a recourse? Yeah. I've never seen this happen with our shop at University of Maryland Department of Surgery residents, but I know it has happened where someone just isn't fit for duty, so to speak.
Yeah.
And the only case I remember distinctly that was involved with, this is not the same thing. This resident at GW, after I left, in the ER, working up a patient and got shot in the head by the patient.
Yeah.
Gosh. And had craniotomy, but still had seizures. And he was on medication for seizures. So the issue was, could he operate? Could he still be? Yeah, okay. The GW program they were coming up to shock trauma, like I had come up.
Yeah.
Told me this kid has a seizure potential, but he's fine now. We haven't had a problem with him. And he had a seizure in the OR with me.
Yeah.
And I had to call the program GW back and say he had a seizure and think this is not safe.
Yeah.
For him. And they told me, said, yeah, he had had a seizure because he decides not to take his medication.
Okay.
So that's irresponsible.
Sure.
So they made him leave the program.
Got it.
And for that reason, because he was being irresponsible about taking his anti-seizure medication.
Yeah.
But that's the only case I know personally, and I'm sure there are cases, but the cases I do know of but not involved with are cases where a resident gets involved with drugs.
Yeah.
And is given one chance and that, and they fail and they're out, totally out.
So we're going to start to come to the close of this, but I've got two more things.
Sure.
Because I could talk to you all night about this stuff. And the first one is I think you know these statistics, but the current statistics are that doctors right now, we're going to talk about some of the darker side of medicine. Doctors have about twice the likelihood of the average person to commit suicide, the male ones, and women have about four times the likelihood, the latest statistics on physician suicide. And I approached you a while back and I said, you know, given all of this, how do you deal with the cumulative stress? How do you manage the day in, day out parts of the sorrow? And you gave me one of the more fascinating answers I've ever gotten, which I've never forgotten.
Remind me.
I will. And what you said to me was, Preston, believe it or not, there's not that much stress for me. And the reason is I didn't cause the problem. Meaning, I didn't shoot them. I didn't cause their car to crash. I'm the person trying to help. And I don't get to decide everything. And so I'm going to do the best I can do. And I'm very good at what I do. But I don't get to make all the decisions. And if an outcome doesn't go the way I want it to, as disappointing as that may be, it's not for me to carry. That's a summary of our conversation. And I wanted to get your reaction and thoughts on that.
All of us think, you know, you did your best. You know, you did everything. So there's a complication. Hopefully not a missed injury. That always bothers me when I hear about missed injuries. But everyone does their best. I don't know if anyone who shirks their duty, shortcuts things, not at all. So that's my answer to that. Now, I'm sure someone someplace isn't like that. They really think it through, don't care. You do your best and you say with the death. I mean, look, where I am, we get about 7,500 patients a year, around 8,000. And we have about a 90% survival rate, let's say 5% mortality, 5% mortality, 350 deaths a year, 360, 380, whatever it is, deaths a year. That's one a day on the average. So this is not uncommon to see death, not uncommon at all. So I'll say it, you get used to it, but this is your job.
Yeah.
What did bother me in my younger years when a call would come in, there's a 16-year-old teenager male coming in from Anne Arundel County, that's my county, injured from a car accident. I say, oh gosh, is that my son?
Yeah.
My daughter, my son, their family. That's the only time it things I thought about, like, oh, this could be bad, but it never was, of course. Yeah. But it's trite to say it doesn't bother you because it doesn't. It's your job. Yes, it's your job. You see it every day. Yes, you see it every day. And I don't want to use the words get used to it, but that's your job. It's like, do you get used to your job?
But I guess what I'm getting at here is that in our conversations that you've pointed out, it's never been something that you've carried with you.
No.
Yeah.
No, you don't. You leave it there. And it's not like you purposely say, oh, I got to leave this at the door as I go home. You just do. You don't. It's work. You don't take. I never took work home in my brain. Never. My wife was a physician, an obstetrician and gynecologist. We never talked medicine stuff at home ever.
Okay.
Never. It wasn't like a rule. We just didn't. Work was work. This was that.
Yeah.
And you're right. Didn't take it home, but I do. Interestingly enough, I do remember certain deaths. They didn't bother me, but it's just certain unfortunate stuff.
Yeah.
The person who was walking, a very nice person walking on the street, gets robbed. Here's my wallet, to go right ahead, and they shoot him in the head. You know,
okay.
It could have been me.
Yeah.
Could have been you. You did everything you could not to get shot or whatever.
Yeah.
Those sort of things would bother me.
Got it.
Or the pedestrian walking across the thing and someone mows them down. It's you or me.
Yeah.
That bothered me that it could have been me.
Yeah.
But stuff like this stopped at the door.
Got it.
In terms of leaving the hospital, I never took it home.
My last question as we wrap up is that for the people that are listening, and even though you're in the business of training surgeons or medical personnel, there's a lot of people here that their job is to train people, special operations, fire, police, NASA. And so as a person who's been developing humans for decades now to work in critical environments, if you had to speak to folks that were trainers or educators or people working in that environment who were training and developing people to have that moment with that scalpel, maybe it's a gun, maybe it's something, what advice would you give to them?
A couple of things. Be nice to the people you're trying to train, because if you're not, they're not going to learn from you.
Yeah.
Take it down to the level that you were when you were learning the stuff. Take it down to that level. Don't expect them to know everything. Be orderly in the way you approach students and how you approach them. And learn what works and what doesn't work. I've learned over the years what works and what doesn't work. So you'll get a compendium of tools that this one works. This never works. So learn what works and what doesn't work. But I think being even keeled to students who are trying to learn from you, remember, you were there once. I think that's really important. This is what I think motivates me, is I think when I was a medical student, learning, it was so nice to have someone who could teach me. And you should do the same thing. You know, we should do the same thing. We were in those shoes before. And how did someone help me when I was in those shoes? Being a good educator, being calm, cool, collected, and just doing it well.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much,
sir. Sure.
It's a genuine pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, my pleasure again.
This has been such a fun conversation, so thank you very much.
Good.
And thanks, everybody, again, for joining the TeamCast, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you again for listening to our TeamCast. For more information about the Mission Critical Team Institute, please go to www.missioncti.com or follow us on LinkedIn or Instagram. If you are a Mission Critical Team that wants more information on our courses, please reach out to our Director of Operations, Janice Jackson, at janice@missioncti.com. That's J-A-N-E-S-E @missioncti.com. And once again, thank you, Janice, and thank you to Shelby Rowe Productions for helping us produce the TeamCast. Have a great day.